Hi, Marty Lurie here, Hank McGraw. Baseball, the 1960s, you're a very big part of it. It's a pleasure to meet you. Of course, the McGraw family, well known, of course, in the entertainment field, your brother Tug McGraw. You were a catcher in baseball as well.
I signed as a catcher.
Okay,
the first game I played in pro ball, I started in center field.
Okay.
And over the course of 12 years, I played all nine positions.
Wow.
I pitched one inning in a laugher. We were about seven or eight down. He asked me if I wanted to throw an inning. So I gave up four hits and two more runs. But me and Nolan Ryan are averaging one strikeout per inning career-wise.
Very good. I like that. Hank McGraw with us. But, Hank, take us back to baseball for you as a young man. The New York Mets, of course. This is early in 1962, before the Mets even play a game. Tug McGraw is your brother. Signing. There's a big story here with it.
Yeah, well, a lot of folks say I was the first Mets bonus baby. I signed in 1961, the end of July, and got my feet wet the last month of the season in the Western Carolina League. And that's when I ran smack dab into a lot of problems that baseball was having at the time. But how I happened to sign with the Mets is interesting, because there were 11 teams offering us money. I say us because my dad was handling it for me. So eventually I asked them, will you promise to sign my little brother if I sign with you? And the only one that said yes was Roy Partee of the Mets.
Very good.
He said, Hank, I promise, we'll sign Tug if he puts on 15 pounds.
Okay.
Because when I had just graduated high school then, and he was about 147 pounds as a junior. So Roy said, if he puts on 15 or 20 pounds, I promise. So when he graduated high school, he was only up to almost 160. Not good enough. And so he went to 2 years of junior college, and he got big enough, and Roy Partee, you know, he held up to his promise, and he signed him. Gave him a contingency bonus of a few bucks and sent him to a rookie league in Florida where they were playing 2 7-inning games a day with four teams. It was Detroit, Houston, the Mets, and the Yankees, I think, had a little complex in Cocoa, and they'd play one another every day. Well, play a doubleheader every day. So Tug's first day out, he threw a 7-inning no-no. And, of course, that opened everybody's eyes, and they started paying attention to him then. And meanwhile, I was still struggling around in the minor leagues, and you know that story.
Yeah, well, let's talk about it. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'm looking forward to having you on the show and just hearing the story. So you get signed by the Mets. Now, of course, this is Casey Stengel's Mets and George Weiss and all that, and you're a bonus baby.
First, Joan
Payson was the, of course, she was a great horsewoman as well. You know, Joan Payson Whitney had a lot of money. But how much did you get? And talk about the Met experience, because you're a bonus baby for the Mets.
Yeah, I got just under $20,000, and which then was considered a pretty good bonus. But they were all in that same ballpark then, and like I said, I chose the Mets, even though we didn't know anything about them. And it was mainly because of Roy Partee. Did you ever know him?
I never knew him. I know the name, and one of the legendary scouts.
Yeah, and he played for the Boston Braves, one of the great people I've ever known in my baseball experience. And it turned out he was an absolutely honest man and held up his end of the deal and brought Tug along, you know, a couple years later.
All right, so you're now a Met bonus baby. You're a catcher. They put you in the outfield right away, and I think back to the Mets coaching staff in those days, and I think of Rogers Hornsby, I think of Cookie Lavigetto, I think of Stengel, Wes Westrum, and people like that. Did you ever meet any of them?
Rogers Hornsby was my first hitting coach. I never had one growing up, you know. You put me out on my front foot like he used to hit. Of course, he was a big son of a gun. He was about 6'3", 6'4", and just a big man. That had me all messed up, to tell you the truth. They sent me to winter ball that year, where I met Paul and Lloyd Wehner. Paul Wehner weighed about 143 pounds, and he got me on my back foot. and turned me into a semi-slugger. I wasn't what you call a real slugger, but I had a couple of years with, I had 29 one year, and mostly I was down in the teens, so my career kind of progressed slowly. I had some problems with baseball people. There were a lot of problems in the 60s in this country, and one of them followed me into baseball, and that was African-American players getting a short shrift. I got into that war early on, and it didn't help me any as far as advancing, because there were so many, well, you got to just say it, there were so many racists in baseball. I mean, it was full of them. There's an inordinate number of good old boy redneck y'all types that fill up all the organizations coaching and managing in the minor leagues, back then especially. I guess it's not gotten a whole lot better. I understand there's fewer than 6% of the big league players are African American these days, and a lot of that has to do with the police in local communities. They won't let African American kids walk the streets to the to go to baseball practice if they're carrying their equipment, because they roust them and say they're involved in gang activity because they're carrying weapons, is how they define baseball bats.
Well, you're in St. Petersburg with the Mets, and I know Florida. I grew up in Miami, Florida, and I know that area of the country. So it was an issue in the early 60s and still is to some extent in the world today.
Well, especially
but,
in Florida.
Yeah, and for baseball players, they had to live in different housing in those days.
The players on our ball club couldn't stay in the same hotels we were staying in. And, in fact, they couldn't stay in any of the hotels. And generally, in my case, in the minors I was playing in, the black players knew of families in the different towns who would house them. It got around through the game, and players found out about it. And so rather than fool around with it, the management just let them stay with these private families for the most part when I was playing. And
so when you say you got involved with it, were you outspoken about it? What did you do?
I fought back. I yelled and screamed about it to anybody who would listen, coaching and managing. And I got in some jams about it because they'd tell you, well, I'll tell you a true story. We came back off a road trip one day, and I had been in the back of the bus singing, and there were three black players on that ball club, and we just sit in the back of the bus and doo-wop, doo-wop. I've always been a singer. And so the next day, a manager calls me in the office. He said, you know, you've got a lot of potential in this game. He says, you can run. You got a good arm. You have skills that that can get you a long ways in this game. With those kind of skills, there are many ways you can get ahead in this game. And he said, direct quote, sitting in the back of the bus with those isn't one of the ways you'll get ahead. And I got up and walked out of his office because my instincts were to hit him. And I've fought that instinct with everything I had. I'm going to get emotional because that stuff still bothers me.
I'll take it. All right. Boy, with Hank McGraw, and I know the story, and I grew up in Florida, and I know what you're talking about. The 60s were part of that. It was such change in the country. JFK is assassinated. How about that? What about that?
That tore us up, didn't it? It seemed like things were caving in around you then. And then gradually, you know, we kind of came out of it, but it was almost like a sign of the times. It felt uneasy in the country, and it had you looking around a lot.
But you played a lot of baseball in the minor leagues in the 60s. Let's talk a little bit about your baseball career and the towns you went to, because the world was changing. We had marijuana in the world on a mass basis for the first time. It had always been there, but in the 60s it was sort of a sign of the change of the 60s and the speaking out of the 60s. So you talk about that a little bit, but the towns you played in, what was that like?
You know, it was hard to find marijuana in all those baseball towns. since you brought it up, I started with marijuana in 1965. And by 1967, I was a regular. And by the early 70s, my guy up north of here was doing his thing. He's still there. He's put over 600 kids through college, and he's still growing, and he's done very well for himself. He's got an apartment in Paris, and he's got three homes in Hawaii and so on. But he's a social guy, and he takes care of all those kids and all the gals that trim and everything, takes care of their families. And it's a great thing, possibly, if people treat it right and don't get too weird over it, it could really help this country out. The other thing is, I'm involved with some people who are studying labs in Berkeley, Steep Hill Lab, and in Santa Cruz. There are a lot of scientists that are going inside the plant. Has nothing to do with the THC or the stone, but there are a lot of things involved in the cannabinoids and the terpenoids and terpenes and so on that they feel they can do a lot of good things with regarding the brain, especially, and brain tumors and different brain diseases, along with many other ways that they can help human beings and pets. So we're going to... We're in the business of getting a foundation going in my name to raise money for these scientists so that they can go in and find the tools they need within the plant to work these cures. Problem is, the feds still have pot listed as a Class A drug. So whenever the scientists get a lab in a going, the feds come in and shut it down because it's a Class A drug, and they can outweigh whatever the state laws are.
What I love about your story, and you're a baseball player, a famous name, you could hit, you could run, but it was the 60s, and I must say you became a victim almost of the 60s because it did impact your baseball career, and you had a shot to get up to the big leagues at the end of the decade.
I went to a couple big league camps and actually did pretty well. I got two hits off of Whitey Ford one day. But I couldn't keep my mouth shut. And it had to do not just with pot, but how a lot of the African-American players were being treated. And if you stand up and bark about stuff like that, you get a tag. And once I got that tag, I started letting my hair grow a little bit and kind of took that path, which didn't help any. You may remember when that all came down and they Phillies... suspended me without pay for a long time. And Marvin Miller jumped on that. He called me. He said, we need to win this case because this is going to start happening in the big leagues, and I want a precedent now. So he took my case, and he got all my money back and from the suspension, all the travel money and everything. He was a good guy. I liked him a lot. I hadn't known him before that, but he jumped on me to help.
That's Hank McGraw. Hank, thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome. Very welcome.
All right, more coming up right after this.